Good morning.
Good morning.
I, like Juliet, am excited to be able to be here today. We live far enough away that we rarely get to see our friends, Juliet and Kelly, so it's a blessing to be in this worship space together. I'd like to start with a story this morning about a man named John Woolman. John Woolman, who lived from 1720 to 1772, was a Quaker who lived in colonial New Jersey among other merchants and farmers in the Society of Friends whose affluence depended on enslaving human beings, who, like them, had names and families, histories, and hopes. Woolman, a tailor who did not own slaves, was torn by the blatant contradiction between the Quaker belief in human equality and the fact that many Quaker gentry were slaveholders. He refused to make that tension disappear by ignoring it, using theological sleight of hand, or riding its energy toward violence. Instead, he insisted that his community hold that tension with honesty and resolve it with integrity by freeing their slaves. Quakers make decisions by consensus instead of majority rule. And Woolman's local meeting or congregation was unable to reach unity on his proposal. Nonetheless, persuaded of Woolman's absolute integrity on the matter, they agreed to support him as he pursued the concern. For the next 20 years, Woolman made frequent trips up and down the East Coast visiting friends in their homes and their shops, at their farms and in their meetings. He spoke with his fellow Quakers about the heartbreaking contradiction between their faith and their practice, and he was always true to his beliefs. He wore undyed white clothing because dye was a product of slave labor. At meals, he would fast rather than eat food prepared or served by slaves. Even if he stayed to talk, and if he learned that he had inadvertently benefited from a slave's work, he would pay the person his or her due without calling attention to the exchange. Woolman and his family paid a great price for his consistent witness to truth's imperatives and his deeply felt heartbreak. Nonetheless, he held that tension, held it for 20 long years, until the Quakers became the first religious community in America to free their slaves, some 80 years before the Civil War. In 1783, Quakers petitioned Congress to correct the complicated evils and unrighteous commerce created by the enslavement of human beings. Needless to say, that petition was not well accepted by the Congress in that time. But the work of John Woolman was deep and intense and intentional and full of tension for over 20 years. John Woolman died when he was 51 years old, and of that 51 years, he spent over 20 years working tirelessly to change hearts and minds within his own circle of influence on a social and political practice that he found unacceptable. 20 of 51 years. Nearly 40% of his life he spent working to fix a social evil that he was so deeply convicted could not be acceptable within his community of faith. He worked hard during those 20 years to bring light where there was darkness. And that, in my estimation, is exactly what our faith practice is about. Whatever it is that we find in this world that is contradictory to the things we most deeply believe about human existence and about something larger than ourselves. I saw Juliet sweat a little bit this morning before she read that book, and she said to me, "I'm about to say God more times than anyone has said it in this building in a year." And I hope you'll forgive her that was my suggestion. And if it works better for you, you can replace every single place that that Desmond Tutu book says the word God with love or peace or justice or spirit. All of those things have dreams, and we are the embodiment of those dreams. And it is only when we give ourselves to the tension that is the contradiction of those highest dreams for our existence and the places where we find ourselves today. Only when we give ourselves to the work of that tension are we able to realize those dreams, like what was read in that book. When I chose the topic for our discussion today, it was last Tuesday, an election day. And I was irritated and disenchanted and frustrated, not with any results of the election, because it was only 8 o'clock in the morning. There were no results yet. Actually, it was more like 10 o'clock in the morning, because I had been a couple of places and I had voted. And when I went to vote, I picked up my little I voted sticker and I put it on and I proudly wore it out into the public, and I went to do the other errands that I needed to do before I went to work. And so I had to go pick up some documents at the county courthouse. And as I was going through the security to go pick up my documents, the security guard noted my I voted sticker and he said, "Oh, you voted. It's an election day." And I said, "Yes, it is." And I walked on through, and as I was turning the corner and walking up the steps, I heard him turn to his coworker and say, "There's nothing major on the ballot, is there?" And a part of me had to hold myself back from turning around and walking back down those steps and saying, "No, of course not. There's nothing major on the ballot. Only 5 of your 10 city council members who make all of the ordinances that govern your everyday civic life and your employment in this community and your streets and your sidewalks and your police and your fire and your public transportation and the mayor, the one who decides in the instance that the city council can't come to an agreement, the mayor gets to break the tie in the vote. And 2/7 of your local school board are being elected today, the ones that govern the education of the 8,934 students in the Jefferson City Public School District and all of their families. But no, there's nothing major on the ballot today." And as I walked out of the courthouse, disgusted with the apathy and, quite frankly, the ignorance among us of the importance of our participation in this society, I thought, we've got to talk about this. And so here we are today, talking about building just and loving communities. But you see, what happens when you're a pastor or a preacher or a speaker of any sort is that often you get into the weeds and you start writing what you're going to say, and it never turns out like you thought it was going to. And so when I started thinking about building just and loving communities, I thought, who do I know that is most deeply involved in the work of building just and loving communities? And I immediately went to a man who I deeply, deeply admire named Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker. And I think I admire him so deeply because he helps me to channel my inner Quaker slash educator kind of person of faith, who finds ourselves in the struggles a lot. And so I thought to myself, I've been wanting to get into Parker Palmer's book, Healing the Heart of Democracy. And so I started sort of reading that book this week. You can imagine my excitement as I started to read that book, and I came to the place in that book where there was an enumerated list. Because I'm a preacher. And there's nothing that excites us more than alliteration and enumerated lists. And I am personally not a fan of alliteration, so I get really excited about the enumerated lists. Parker Palmer writes, "If we the people are to help heal our ailing democracy, and if we do not, who will? We need to develop 5 crucial habits of the heart. Yes, that's it. Habits of the heart. We need to develop habits of the heart. But to be honest with you, and I have to be honest because if I stand up here and lie to you, you're going to know that I'm lying and it doesn't work out well. What I was really thinking is they need to establish habits of the heart. They do. Because something's wrong, clearly, with their hearts. And so I started reading the list. And the first of the habits of the heart that we need to develop to heal our ailing democracy is an understanding that we are all in this together. I am a pastor of a church full of people who have been shut out, full of people who have literally come to communion tables and said, "You can't have this." Full of people who have been thrown out of their homes, full of people who have been told that they don't belong. And all of those people make up the community that we are. I know better than anyone that we are all in this together, right? Because that's my call in life, is to help people to understand how it is that we're interconnected and how it is that if my friend over here doesn't have a place to sleep or food to eat, then that affects me. And if children don't have a proper education and opportunities to thrive and to be who they were created to be, then that affects my children and my world that I live in. So I understand that we are all in this together. Until I get to the place where I do my day job, which is the Capitol. And somebody sends me a message that says, "Hey, can you go to that children's and families hearing this morning?" Because they're hearing a bill that says that people who are recipients of temporary assistance for needy families, which we call TANF, hearing a bill that people who receive that cash grant, which goes onto their EBT card, can't use their EBT card to get cash out from their cash grant with which they pay their rent and other things that you can't swipe an EBT card for. The sponsor of the bill was describing the point of the bill, and he was saying that we can't let them do that because they buy whiskey and meth and prostitutes and pornography. And over again, he said, whiskey and meth and prostitutes and pornography. And when I left that hearing, actually before I left that hearing, I sent my boss a text message and I said, "I can't come to this hearing anymore because I am starting to feel violent tendencies and I am a nonviolent person. And you're gonna have to get me some hazard pay for this." And so I leave the hearing and I'm angry. And I have to tell you that when I left that hearing angry, the last thing on my mind was that we are all in this together, in the sense that me and that legislator were in this together. And Parker Palmer, in his gentle way, reminded me that to say that we are all in this together doesn't just mean that me and all those great people that I want to be a champion for are in this together, but that me and all those great people that I want to be a champion for and all those people that I find myself being a champion against, we're all in this together. And then I went on to read that the second habit of the heart that we needed was an appreciation of the value of otherness. I'm a lesbian, right? I get this. I appreciate the value of otherness. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. I found myself called to be a pastor. I went to my preacher and told him, and he laughed at me. And I went somewhere else where they ordain women just because they ordain women. And then I went, "Oh, I'm gay. That's not going to work." So I've been experiencing this otherness thing for a long time, and for me it was like walking into my skin, and I was just okay with it. And I loved the value of otherness. I loved the way that it allowed me to relate to other people who had been shut out for lots of different reasons. And I could hear Parker Palmer talking to me quietly to say that I don't appreciate all otherness. Again, I don't appreciate the otherness of those people who, out of their deeply held religious beliefs, turned my friend away from the communion table. I don't appreciate that kind of otherness. And so I started feeling this tension, and I read the next line that said that the next habit of the heart that we needed to develop was an ability to hold tension in life-giving ways. And I don't know about you all, but my default for dealing with tension and conflict is avoidance. I will do anything that I can to not be in the middle of the tension. I will excuse whatever actions you have just perpetrated against me. I'll say, no, it's okay. It's all good. Because I don't want to be in that tension. And we do this all the time in our lives. We find ourselves in spaces of tension that could be growing edges for us. And we put our hands up and we say, no, 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 no. I don't want to go there. I don't want to feel that. Let's just all be okay. John Woolman held that tension, not just among people that he didn't know, but in his own local faith community. He held the tension for 20 years to say what we are doing, not what you are doing, but what we are doing as a community is wrong, and we have to change it. And the next habit that we have to develop is a sense of personal voice and agency. Wait, you mean I have to say something? Because there's a lot going on in this world that we have something to say something about, right? And we sit at home and we read the newspaper and we watch the news on TV, and we may curse at the people who are talking, and we may talk about how ridiculous something is, but a personal voice and sense of agency means that I have to speak my truth out loud. I have to speak my truth so that you can hear it, and so that those people across the way can hear it, and so that the legislator sponsoring the bill that deeply, deeply offends me and the people that I serve, so that they can hear it. Because it doesn't do us any good to hold a truth if we're not going to speak that truth. And the last habit that Parker Palmer says we have to cultivate in our hearts is a capacity to create community. We don't accomplish anything in this world by ourselves. This is the reason that you are all here on this Sunday morning, because you have at some point had the capacity to create community by identifying the space of spiritual growth and nurture that feels right to you. And you've stepped into it, and you've given yourselves to it in a way that a community is created. Parker Palmer writes that Rosa Parks and the courage to do what Rosa Parks did could only happen in community. Because there was a village of people around her who taught her the value of persons, the value of humanity, regardless of color of skin. It's that capacity to create community. And so those five habits of the heart, it seems, are what we need to start healing our democracy. And I started to think about why it's so difficult for us. It seems like we should be able to work toward those things. It seems like we should be able to make some progress. Last night at our church, we were talking about doubt and its place in our growth. And I was reading a Buddhist teaching about doubt that said that doubt really exposes us to the truth if we follow it to the end. But we have neither the insight, the courage, nor the training. We have been schooled in a sterile addiction to contradiction that has robbed us repeatedly of all real openness to any more expansive and ennobling truth. Terry Tempest Williams writes that the human heart is the first home of democracy. It is where we embrace our questions. Can we be equitable? Can we be generous? Can we listen with our whole beings and not just our minds, and offer our attention rather than our opinions? And do we have enough resolve in our hearts to act courageously, relentlessly, without ever giving up, ever trusting our fellow citizens to join with us in our determined pursuit of a living democracy, even if it takes them 20 years to get there? What if every time our heart was broken over something, we used it as an opportunity to empathize with someone else, and not someone with whom it's easy to empathize, but someone who pushes us to our very limits? Palmer shares two images of broken hearts. The first is a heart that is bitter, and when it breaks, it shatters into thousands of tiny shards, nearly impossible to reassemble into anything that gives life. But there's another kind of broken heart, he says, the heart that is supple. The supple heart can be broken into a greater capacity to hold our own and the world's pain. When we hold our suffering in ways that open us up to greater compassion, heartbreak becomes a source of healing. It is this kind of tension holding that we need to use to create just and loving communities. The Hebrew prophet Isaiah knew some things about being a holder of tension for and with his community. In Isaiah 58, he gives us an if-then proposition about how the world is going to become a better place. He says, if you do away with the yoke of oppression, with the pointing of the finger and malicious talk, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness, and your night will become like the noonday. You will be like a well-watered garden. Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins and will raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called the repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets with dwellings. In other words, builder of just and loving communities. You and I are the foremen on these job sites. We have to orchestrate the change of heart, first in ourselves, and then in our families and our workplace and on our block and in our neighborhood and in our city and our state and our nation. But it all begins with the development of our own healthy heart. The human heart is the first home of democracy. Thank you.